Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Robert Colville, editor of CapEx, and today I'll be talking to Lord Lawson. Nigel Lawson is one of the most eminent politicians in the country. As well as having been Chancellor under Margaret Thatcher, he's been editor of The Spectator, a columnist and editor at the Financial Times and Sunday Telegraph, speechwriter to two prime ministers, and most recently one of the most influential figures behind the scenes during the Brexit campaign. We'll be looking back on his extraordinary career and looking forward to what he sees as the biggest challenges and opportunities facing Britain.
Matthew Elliott, who led Vote Leave, recently called you one of the sort of forgotten heroes of the campaign, saying that your sort of influence over the Tory party was one of the sort of key factors in attracting support for Brexit. I mean, why was that something that you were campaigning on so strongly?
It was not so much a matter of campaigning. It was deciding to come out in favour of our leaving the European Union. I formed that view that we'd be better off out. We were in a peculiar position anyway of being half in and half out by being in the European Union but outside the monetary union and the single currency. So we were half in and half out, which showed that we really didn't believe in the project and want to be. And I didn't think this was very satisfactory. And I decided that we would be better off out if we didn't want to go totally in, which was right not to. And I kept my own counsel because for some time because I hadn't seen a way in which we could easily get out. Until David Cameron's Bloomberg speech, in which he promised that if he was elected, there would be a referendum on this. And that meant that there was a real prospect then. Until there, that, you know, not likely, there was a real prospect. So I decided in early 2013 to come out with my views and say we should, when the referendum happens, we should vote to leave. I had expressed this view privately, and it got to the ears of the editor of the Times, who asked me if I would write a piece, and I said, well, I will on two conditions. I'd like to choose when I think the time is right, and also I want a longer space to develop the argument than you customarily give. And he said, what did I say? I want 2,000 words. I can't do it in fewer than 2,000 words. Can't do justice to it. So he said, okay. I chose the time when to do it and did it. I was very lucky in the sense that it happened to be a very thin news day. So in addition to the think piece inside the paper, they splashed it on the front page, which fortunately gave it much more impact than it would otherwise have had.
But I mean, as Matthew says, that was kind of the dam bursting. So
yes.
I mean, Charles Moore says that Lady Thatcher came to the same conclusions at pretty much the same time, but was told if you come out and say this, you will be banished from polite society. No one will
That's
take
right.
you seriously.
That's right.
I mean, were you conscious that you were kind of breaking a taboo?
Absolutely. Yes. We live in an age where the blight of political correctness on a whole range of issues is one of the worst things about the present time. And this was certainly one of them. But it was perhaps easier for me than it was easier for these many people. I mean, I didn't mind being banished from polite society. I couldn't damage my political career because my political career had already happened. So, but it was. I was very conscious to use your phrase, that I was breaching a taboo.
And then during the campaign, or sort of in the run-up to the campaign, you lobbied former ministers, you became chairman briefly of Vote Leave.
Yes, I didn't actually lobby ministers. My views had been set out in the article in the Times, and when I was talking to my friends, we would sometimes discuss the issue, and I would explain more fully my position and why I thought it was the right thing for this country. Taking over the as an interim chairman of Vote Leave happened because I was very concerned the way things were happening in Vote Leave. And there were a whole lot of problems which I won't go into. And I was worried about it. And I asked Matthew to come and see me here in the House of Lords, not in this room. And he shared my concern. And he said, well, would you be prepared to come in as chairman and sort it out? And I said, well, I'm prepared to come in with two conditions. First of all, I wanted to bring somebody else in as well onto the board, Michael Forsyth, Lord Forsyth, who was an excellent man. I needed to have a close ally on the board with me if I was going to be chairman. The other thing, I said, I will only do it as an interim thing, because I'm too old. I mean, I'm very old. In 3 weeks' time, I shall be nearer 90 than 80, and that's old by any standards. And I said that when cabinet ministers are allowed to come out, because you remember what happened, they should take up the running. They're the right generation. But I will be prepared to step in on an interim basis until then. There had been an attempted rebellion, as you know. It was an unhappy ship at the time. So the order was needed and sanity. And there was another thing too, which was very much being talked about, where the media had got it particularly wrong. Which the media frequently do. And that was we were being mocked, we on the Leave side, by the virtue of there were two different Leave organisations. The media said this is ridiculous, two different organisations. It's like the Monty Python thing about the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea. That was completely mistaken. There had to be two different organisations because there were two different natures and two different sorts of people who were appealing to. And I had to knock the idea of a merger on the head. But of course that had consequences because our Labour Party friends were very unhappy about these two different groups. And it was very important that we didn't seem to be just a Tory group. And so one of the things I felt the most important thing that I could do, in addition to knocking on the head the idea of a merger, I mean, I spoke to the other side and said, look, we shouldn't be firing at each other, but we keep our own separate identities. But I also felt that we had to strengthen the non-Tory representation. And I was able to persuade, and he wouldn't have come on board otherwise, I was able to persuade David Owen, who was an old friend of mine, to come on to join Vote Leave.
Because he was thinking of setting up his own sort of parallel organisation.
Yeah, he had said, he's an old friend of mine, we had discussions, and he had said that he was going to do his own thing. And I persuaded him, when I... to join Vote Leave. And he said, well, Nigel, if you're going to be chairman, then I will join Vote Leave. And that was important. And it was important for another reason. Because Gisela Stewart, I mean, David is ex-Labour. He's, of course, himself, I think, an independent social democrat now. But Gisela remains a Labour member of Parliament. Gisela had also said she would do her own thing in concert with David. And so when David said he would come on board, Vote Leave, he brought Giesler with him, in effect. And that was, I think, useful. And that made it no longer look like just a Tory outfit.
Yes, and she ends up being one of the key...
That's right.
The key
That's right.
figures in,
That's
the,
right.
in the team.
Mm.
So moving on to the sort of aftermath of the referendum, I mean, are you sort of happy with how things have gone since? I mean,
yeah,
obviously Leave itself has kind of dwindled away, but the baton has been taken
anymore.
By.
Yes, no. No, the ball has been passed to the government, and I think Theresa May is doing a very good job at the moment. Excellent.
And I mean, so you said that you think sort of no deal would be better than a bad deal.
Well, I didn't say that. I mean, I was quoting. I mean, that is, first of all, what Theresa May said, and this was then repeated in the white paper. And that's right, absolutely.
So
we're talking about trade deals.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other things that have to be discussed, but this is on the key issues of a trade deal, and I don't think a trade deal is possible, certainly not a good one, and no trade deal is better than a bad trade deal.
So you'd argue for WTO terms or...
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, WTO terms, plus there are one of the most important things we have to decide is how we are going to conduct ourselves once we are outside the European Union, when we are free to take our own decisions. And on the trade front, there may well be various tariffs which we will want to decide unilaterally to eliminate, the foodstuffs which we don't really produce much in this country. For
coffee,
example.
Oranges.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Common Agricultural Policy has hugely high tariffs. The average tariff on agricultural products is higher than the average tariff on industrial products under the Common External Tariff of the European Union. And so there may be all sorts of things that that guy wants to do, because the WTO only tells you the maximum tariffs, in effect, that you can have. The WTO is the trade agreement that really matters, this World Trade Agreement. And that gives you a maximum. Any country is free to have something less or zero.
Going back, you mentioned that you've come to the view that Britain couldn't be half in and half out. But, I mean, obviously, as Chancellor, you're quite closely associated with an attempt to take Britain further in, the shadowing of the Deutschmark.
No, the shadowing of the Deutschmark is quite different. It's often misunderstood, although I explain it very clearly in my memoirs, which I wrote a long, long time ago. Shadowing of the Deutschmark was a financial discipline akin to the old gold standard. I was concerned about inflation. Inflation is influenced, although it is monetary policy, which is the policy for getting inflation down. It is made much harder if inflationary expectations remain high. And because of the inflation that had been, the great inflation in the 1970s, even in the 1980s, inflationary expectation was still, at that time, quite high. And I wanted a discipline which would help to bring inflationary expectations down. The gold standard, which had done a very good job in the days of the gold standard, in that group, was no longer, you know, had no longer any credibility. Having a kind of link with the Deutschmark would have vital credibility, but it didn't happen. I mean, because Margaret Thatcher vetoed it, so it never actually happened. But that's what I think. But there was nothing political about it, nothing about the European Union had nothing to do with it. I think people are often confused between that and the common currency. Of course, the common currency, the single currency, the European currency, which was entirely political, but that didn't happen until after I'd ceased being Chancellor.
And so your argument on the ERM would be that we joined, not that we, it was a mistake to join, but we joined too late at the wrong level.
I think that if we had joined at an earlier stage and at the right level, it might have helped in the struggle against inflation, but we didn't, and that's that.
Fair enough. So going right back to the beginning, one thing I didn't realise until I began researching this was that your family name, well, originally your family name was Leibson. Leibson, sorry.
That was my paternal grandfather, but that was a long, long time ago. I mean, he came here as a 16-year-old in the 19th century, Queen Victoria on the throne and all that. It was a different age, quite different.
Sure, but the thing is, I mean, you are... I mean, at the heart of the establishment, we're in the middle of a gorgeously appointed room in the House of Lords. You've, as I mentioned before, you've edited The Spectator. You went to Westminster or Oxford. You've been Chancellor of the Exchequer. Mm. Yet you're—I mean, you mentioned your memoirs. The title of those is "Memoirs of a Tory Radical." Mm. I mean, have you always felt that tension between sort of insider and outsider establishment and radicalism, or have you just sort of followed your own style?
I followed my own style. I mean, my father went to Westminster. That's why I went to Westminster. I have always been my own man, but I've always been very comfortable in the Conservative Party, which I've known for a long time. The Conservative Party, like big parties tend to be, is itself a kind of a coalition, and I am rather on the sort of radical libertarian wing of the Conservative Party, and in that context, of course, I had a lot in common with Margaret Thatcher.
So was this? I mean, were you a sort of cultural Tory, as you, because you mentioned your father was in finance, or was it a?
No, he wasn't in finance. So. No, my father was a tea merchant. He was a successful tea merchant in the City of London and had a high reputation there, partly because of his integrity, which was a byword, but also because he had a remarkably fine palate. He could taste tea and tell you exactly where it had come from. Like some people are very good with wine, he was very good with tea.
So presumably that's something which runs in the family, given your daughter's career.
No, I don't think it has anything to do with it. I don't think she is into tea in a big way.
But presumably she's got quite a refined palate, as a.
Oh yes, no, she has her own great strengths, but I don't think there's much in common. I know you like things linked, but I don't think there's much in common with that being a tea merchant. I prefer wine, I have to say.
You didn't start out in politics. You started, like many other Tory politicians, you started, and Labour politicians, you started out as a journalist.
Yes, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I was always interested in public affairs and public policy. I decided that maybe I would go into the Foreign Office, and I sat the examination for the Foreign Office and did very well in the examination. Then there was after that the interview stage, and they decided that I wasn't the type to go into the Foreign Office. They were absolutely right, and thank God I didn't, because I had a much more interesting career than if I had gone into the Foreign Office.
Did they say why you weren't the type?
No, they just gave me a mark, which meant that I nearly got in, but not quite. And it meant that I was then subsequently interviewed, which they did those days, for the Secret Service. Because if you would then be in the Foreign Office, you see, but nobody would know that you were a funny. But I didn't want that.
So there's an entire parallel history where you were ambassador to Washington as opposed to...
I don't know. I think they were right that I'm not the Foreign Office type. I think they're absolutely right.
And so how did journalism come about?
Journalism came about because at that time the Financial Times had a very... as far as the editorial side was concerned, not about advertising and all that. The Financial Times, which is a good paper, had a curious recruitment policy. They first of all recruit only men. This wouldn't be accepted today. Secondly, they had to have a first or second class degree, but it had to be from either Oxford or Cambridge. No other university was acceptable. But if you fit into that category, which I did, then you would get a better starting salary than you would get in most things at that time. But in particular, you would be on a national newspaper. All the other national newspapers expected you to do time on a provincial paper before you could go to...
Which was still the case for many years afterwards.
That's right. So there was quite a good group of us. Andrew Schonfield, William Rees-Mogg, I mean, these names won't mean...
I think William Rees-Mogg still has
right. And we all joined. And it was a very good group.
And of course, and you then worked your way up. You were city editor at the Sunday Telegraph, and then become editor of the Spectator.
Yeah, I was city editor at the Sunday Telegraph when it started. I was quite young. I was not 30 yet, and it was the first new newspaper, national newspaper, which had started for over 40 years. So that was quite fun. So I could create the city pages from scratch, the sort of city pages that I wanted to do. And I wasn't sort of succeeding anybody because it was a brand new newspaper.
And then you went to the Spectator, where there'd always been a sort of tradition, I suppose, of people sort of going back and forth from Westminster there. I mean, some of your predecessors, I think, had then...
Yeah, I succeeded Ian McLeod as editor. But that was later. Between the Sunday Telegraph and the Spectator, I had an excursion into politics, into political life, which really was what made me decide that I would like to go into politics myself on my own account. And the only reason I didn't do it then, or didn't try to do it then, was because I was out of the blue offered to the editorship of the Spectator, and it's not something that one turns down lightly. So I decided to do that before going into politics.
So when you say excursion into politics, was this standing as an MP? Or?
No, it happened by chance, like most of the things in my life, because I never planned my career. I don't believe in planning anyway. I was telephoned out of the blue by the then chairman of the Conservative Party, Oliver Poole. And he said, "Will you come and see me?" And he said, "Been reading your columns, because I did a weekly, in addition to editing the city and financial coverage of the paper, I did my column, which was largely on, usually on economic policy issues, current issues." And he said, "I've been there and I like them." He said, "The Prime Minister," that was Harold Millen, "his speeches are getting very dull, very boring, and they're like laundry lists. We're building so many miles of motorway and building so many houses and so on. It's not very good. Would you be prepared to come along and help him with his speeches?" And he said, "This is just between now and the general election." It was an election due in 1964, and this was... "And then after that, I will give you a job in Lazards." He was also chairman of Lazards. So I thought, well, you don't turn down lightly an opportunity to work for the Prime Minister, and that would be fun. So I said, "Yeah, I'll do that, but I must, first of all, I owe it to the paper to find a successor. So I can't do it straight away, but as soon as I find a successor, I'll do it." And that took a little time, and I did find a successor, a good successor. But by that time, Harold Millen had fallen ill and decided, he regretted it afterwards because his doctors led him to believe that his illness was far worse than it was. But he was something of a valetudinarian anyway. He'd resigned, and there was
a speechwriter,
and there wasn't a prime minister. Alec Hume was chosen to succeed, and he came in, and he was such a fine gentleman that although he'd inherited me, and we'd only, I think, met once or twice before, he didn't know me at all, whereas I knew Harold a little bit better, he accepted me, and I worked for Alex throughout his time as Prime Minister and had a very high regard for him. And then I said, so I decided that, well, maybe politics is what I would want like to do. But then, instead of going to Lazard's, I was offered the, which if I had gone to Lazard's, I would have been much better off financially. But, you know, the course of my life changed because, first of all, I'd already thought I'd really want to go to politics. But then I was offered the editorship of the Spectator, so that's when that came up. I don't remember, it's, you know, it's a long time ago, and I read it, we're talking about before you were born, I mean, it's a long time ago, I don't remember. My time as city editor of the Sunday Telegraph was very successful. The city pages initially, Sunday Telegraph wasn't very good because everybody else on the Sunday Telegraph, apart from me, had come from the Daily Telegraph. And they had a slogan, at the promoters of the Sunday Telegraph, the Sunday Telegraph fills the gap. And what they meant was the gap in the market between the stuffy side and the tabloids type journalism. But of course the joke was, yes, it does fill the gap between the Saturday Daily Telegraph and the Monday Daily Telegraph. And I did something completely different, and it became very successful, and it kept the paper afloat in the early days. Almost, if you look in the early years of the Sunday Telegraph, almost the only advertising they got was financial advertising, because the city column, city pages were very successful. As an editor of the Spectator, I think probably the most successful thing I did, but I think it was a good paper then, as it is a good paper now, was to get this, this is a rather minority appeal, but nevertheless it appealed to me and it appealed to a number of readers, get this new columnist, Mercurius Oxoniensis, which was the pen name of Hugh Trevor Roper. That was kept great secret at the time. And he wrote in a sort of mock 17th century English in the style of John Aubrey. And it was a pastiche, which he did absolutely brilliantly. And these articles have been published in book form. I mean, they're really very great. So, as editor, I think that was the thing that made me happiest.
And what sort of qualities do you think being a journalist gave you as a politician? Both you and others who've made, including another former editor of The Spectator, who made the same, you know, there's Boris Johnson, Michael Gove.
There are similarities, aren't there? Because you're involved with the same issues, and you are also have to work to deadlines. I mean, when you have to make a speech in the House of Commons, you have to get your speech right, and right on the night or on the day or whatever it is. That is not all that different from having to write a column.
And once you got into Parliament, did it take you a while to sort of find...
And I also knew, of course, there's another read across. If you are an editor of The Spectator, for example, you get to know a large number of politicians. And therefore, you are already, before you go into the House of Commons, au fait with the political world.
So you weren't. So when you get into the Parliament, you're not starting from scratch. You already have a base of acquaintances.
Absolutely. And of course, you are a target because you're known. I mean, most people, when they go into the House of Commons, are not widely known. If you've been into the Spectator, then you are quite well known. So you become a target. People want to take you down a peg or two. in a way that the ordinary new member doesn't experience. The House of Commons can be quite a rough place. And as I said, there is normally an indulgence shown to new members. But it's not the case if you're already a minor public figure.
So things like speaking time or committee appointments and...
No, not that. No, no, it's... No, I think it's not that so much. It is attempt to ridicule you, your opponents attempt to ridicule you in the debate and so on. But that's all right. And I decided that I would make a new name for myself by concentrating on Prime Minister's questions. Harold Wilson was Prime Minister at the time, and he fancied himself Prime Minister's questions as being very smart and having all the answers. And so I enjoyed getting under his skin. And so that was a new thing. And he actually, I think, at one point said that I was his toughest questioner or whatever.
But you weren't doing the whole Ed Balls thing of hand gestures and jeering from the opposition benches. It was...
No, in my day, the House of Commons was a thoroughly polite and well-mannered place.
So did you sort of gravitate fairly quickly towards the Thatcherite elements of the party? The sort of, as you said, libertarian...
Yes, I was quite clear that... Ted Heath, who was the leader when I, the third party when I got in, and who I knew very well, I'd worked for him at a time. I'd taken another time outside journalism when I was asked by Douglas Hurd, who was at that time his political secretary, if I would come and help Ted when he was Prime Minister. So I did that. But it was quite clear to me that for all his qualities, he was a disastrous leader. We need a new leader. And that Margaret Thatcher was the best choice.
But did you have the sort of economic diagnosis at this point? I mean, were you... Did you have the sort of economic diagnosis at this point? Did you sort of feel that Britain needed a rupture with the past?
I did feel that we needed to go towards a market economy in the fullest sense and a financial discipline which would get on top of inflation, which was the main issue. And I was always, right the way from my time writing these articles as city editor of the Sunday Telegraph, I was an opponent of incomes policies, which was at that time considered the way in which you dealt with inflation. But inflation was a problem throughout the 60s, a growing problem. Incomes policy was not the answer, pay policy was not the answer. It had huge adverse effects and didn't actually deal with the inflationary problem. And that financial discipline, both monetary and fiscal.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Was the way ahead.
And was this sort of the result of, I guess, had you sort of read into the subject? I mean, was this a sort of first principles thing from reading Friedman or Hayek or whoever, or was it just the result of practical experience?
Well, I had some knowledge of economics because I'd read PPE at Oxford. My specialist subject was philosophy. I specialised in philosophy. It was on the strength of my philosophy papers, not my economics papers, that I got my first. But nevertheless, you had to do a certain amount of economics, so I was aware of what the economic arguments were and what economists were saying and the curious language they spoke. Then I learned much more, I think. That gave me a grounding. And then going on to the Financial Times, which at that time had a monopoly of financial journalism. That was all changed, but at that time, the city pages of the other newspapers were just stock market tip sheets. There was no economic analysis. It was only the Financial Times had a de facto monopoly there. And so I was invited everywhere, particularly when I became Lex, to all the city people, all the banks and so on, because they wanted to influence the Financial Times. And so I learnt a lot on the job on the FT in the 50s.
Well, which leads us nicely to you becoming Chancellor, where you actually have an opportunity to put this into practice.
That's right. No, I felt when I became Chancellor, I was very lucky. I didn't expect Margaret to make me Chancellor because I was a slightly unconventional figure, but fortunately she was an unconventional Prime Minister. And we got on, our views were very, very similar. But I did feel that all my career, so-called, leading up to that, had in a sense been a preparation for being Chancellor.
I mean, what would you say your biggest legacy is as Chancellor?
Well, I suppose that I think the single biggest thing, but one doesn't just do one thing, was the radical reform of the tax system.
So yes, this is something I wanted to ask, because you made these sweeping changes.
Yes.
And effectively the system we're now left with, where no one pays more than about 40% tax and the bans have been simplified, is the one you left. I mean,
to a large extent, yes. And it's remained completely intact. I mean, it's been changed. Remaining completely intact for something like 20 years, which was quite surprising because at the time it was hugely controversial. Indeed, the 1988 budget was the only time in the whole history of this country when the Speaker had to suspend the sitting because of uproar in the...
Because you were lowering the higher rate?
Yes.
But, I mean, that's not the only dramatic budget moment you have. The year before, you're standing there 2 weeks after the stock market has...
That's right.
I mean, how do you cope with something like that?
Well, you have to create confidence. The problem with the stock market crash was that a whole lot of people, including William Rees-Mogg, incidentally, who were talking about it. He was writing in the Sunday Times. I think it only had been the Times. I think it was the Sunday Times at that time. I can't remember which it was. Saying that this is 1929 all over again. And There was a lot of concern, and businesses were aborting all their investment plans, and of course these things could snowball, and it was very necessary to create an atmosphere of calm confidence, because it was quite clear to me that this was a correction, market, and this was caused by a whole lot of market problems, but there was nothing fundamentally amiss with the world economy. The world economy is not in perfect nick, it never is, but it was a stock market phenomenon rather than an economic phenomenon, and therefore it was my job to create an atmosphere of confidence, which I think to a considerable extent I did, and it was and I made one or two speeches that time outside the House of Commons, which the opposition in the Commons resented, because they think Parliament's where you make it. But I had to do a big thing at the Stock Exchange.
And in 88, similarly, was it just that the opposition benches were infuriated, or was there a sort of wider feeling in the country that this was the Tories favouring the rich? And
the economy was doing well, and that is really what determines public opinion most. If the economy is doing well, and if people's incomes are rising, and we've been through a terrible time in the 1970s, which was what caused the Labour government to be beaten, and Margaret to come in 1979. I became a minister straight away, as you know. She made me a financial secretary right from the word go in 1979. And people by that time had appreciated that things had got a lot better in the 1980s than they were in the 1970s.
And I mean, was there anything?
So that there was there was on the whole goodwill. And we just won the 1987 election. It was quite remarkable. The third in a row, we won 1979, not because of anything Margaret did, because people were up askance at the idea of a woman prime minister, which never happened. But the people had formed a clear opinion, insofar as one can say this, that Labour had had its day. And so she got in a sense, by default. But then that first term, 1979 to 1983, was a successful period. The economy began to turn around, and so re-elected then. And then things got even better between 83 and 87. And for the third election in a row, she won. So we were in a strong position in 1988. And I decided to do the controversial thing in 1988, because it's common sense that if there's anything controversial you want to do, you do it in the beginning of a parliament, when the next election is a long way off, so that you will not be judged by the measures, but you'll be judged by the outcome of those measures. And if the outcome of those measures is satisfactory, then that's fine.
And in this case, that was removing the higher rate of tax.
Yes. So and there were other things too. But they're all set out in my memoirs. But I think that, and I did a huge amount of tax simplification. I lowered a lot of tax rates and abolished a number of taxes, and still managed to, which seems odd if you look at it today, balance the books, and in fact got a surplus on the public accounts.
So is there anything you did as Chancellor that you now look back on and regret, or that you wish you'd done?
I don't look back.
fair enough, apart from in this interview. Mm-hmm. So, obviously, you've touched on it before, but a huge part of the job of a Chancellor is dealing with the Prime Minister, and your own relationship with Margaret Thatcher is extremely well chronicled. I mean, what do you think the sort of key attributes are for that relationship to work, and how well do you think it's worked in the years since?
Well, there are obviously two things which are desirable. One is a similarity of views. I mean, as I said, Margaret Thatcher and I both had a similar, you know, were in a similar part of the spectrum of views, that is the Conservative Party. So there's a similarity of perspective and outlook and views. And the other thing is personal compatibility. And although I fell out with her at the end, that was after a long time of working very closely together, starting in opposition, in fact, and then throughout our time in government. There was a, you know, although our personalities were quite different, we got on very well.
And what have been the most successful partnerships since?
Well, I think the there have been a wide range. I mean, the closest one, I think possibly it may have, with the wisdom of hindsight, been too close. The closest one was between David Cameron and George Osborne.
And I've been told you're more of an admirer of the Chancellor in that arrangement than the Prime Minister.
Yeah, I think that David Cameron moulded himself on Tony Blair. It was all about image. Whereas George does like to think things through. He has a much more intellectual approach. He's political at his fingertips, but he does have this he is as seriously interested in analysing economic issues. At the end of the day, of course, he always deferred to David, but he did a number of good things, George,
in terms of shrinking the size of the public sector, sticking to deficit reduction.
Yes, right.
You could have sort of gone into a gilded retirement in the Lords after you leave office. Instead, you set up the Global Warming Policy Foundation and make yourself a target for all manner of criticism.
That's right.
You've been called a climate change, Britain's leading climate change skeptic, Britain's leading climate change denier. Essentially, there's a lot of people who very, very strongly disagree with you on this. I mean, why get involved in that world?
I've become interested in this new issue that had come up, climate change, which didn't cross our desk in government, really, at all, when I was in government.
I mean, Thatcher makes a famous speech about greenhouse gases and the need to conserve the planet as a conservative cause.
Yeah, well, yes. She is not quite in those terms, but she does make this speech. And we said we should, which she was saying, we want to know more about it, we must be careful about this. But there were no policy implications at all. She just said we need to know more. So it wasn't an issue at that time at all. And I'm not one to look back at all. I like to look forward to new things. So I thought, I must find out about this climate change thing. Was educate myself. At that time, I was a member of the Economic Affairs Committee, Select Committee of this House, and we had to decide what our subject we would look at. And I suggested to my colleagues that we should look into the economics of climate change. I knew nothing about the subject at the time. I was trying to learn about it. And so we did an inquiry, a rather good inquiry, I think, into the economics of climate change. And it was clear to me, I had initially taken the whole thing at its face value, but I just didn't know about it. And I discovered that the whole thing was a great deal more complex. and that a lot of people have been talking a lot of nonsense. So I decided to write a book about it because of this blight of political correctness, because the problem with the whole climate change thing is that it is not only this stultifying political correctness, but it has become for many people a kind of substitute religion. And you know, I believe in rational analysis. I don't like this quasi-religious approach to these issues. So I based on what I'd learned, and plus further research I'd done, learned doing this House of Lords inquiry into the economics of climate change. And I wrote this book, which because of this political correctness, no British publisher would touch. Quite extraordinary. And despite the fact that I'd already had 3 books out and all, and done well and never had any difficulty in finding a publisher, but on this, no British publisher would touch it. Eventually, my daughter Nigella, who was a successful author, said, well, why don't you try my agent? And I got in touch with him, and he didn't want to upset her by not finding a publisher. So he managed to find a smallish independent American publisher who had an even smaller British subsidiary, and they published it, and it became a bestseller, and was rather comically, it became on Amazon's list of the 10 best-selling environmental books, because that was the category of the decade. And it was on the back of the success of that book that I found a think tank. A number of people said, well, Nigel, you can't just leave it here. You must carry on and write another book. And I thought, well, what would another book add to what I'd already written? It would not add a great deal, add something, but I'd had my say and done it quite briefly, and so that it could be easy to read. I decided I'd start a think tank, which is what I did. We have a first-class full-time director, Benny Beiser, and it has achieved, I think, a position which is well-known throughout the English-speaking world, and indeed perhaps something on the continent of Europe as well. There's no other think tank like us. We're the only think tank. There are other think tanks which have a wider compass of interests and do things on climate change from time to time, but we're the only one that does that exclusively. That's one subject.
And, I mean, what's your sort of your objection on this? Is it the amount of money that are going to be spent?
The title of my book was An Appeal to Reason, and that has always been what I'm about. And it's about looking at this thing rationally, instead of in this emotional and quasi-religious way. Let us look at this thing rationally. What is the evidence, and what are the policies, if any, one should implement? And what are the consequences of the policies that we are committed to and are trying to ignore? And I think it is absolutely intolerable that we are pursuing policies which have completely messed up energy policy in this country, which imposes a quite unnecessary burden on British business and industry and the economy, and in particular imposes a huge burden on the individual households, particularly poor households, who are having to pay far more for their energy than they need pay, and to no good effect whatever. Just so that people can prance around saying what a wonderful example the United Kingdom is setting.
So you'd have no objection to renewable energy if it was priced
Oh, it's huge. No, I'm very happy. Look, the reason we use fossil fuels is because they are the cheapest and most reliable form of energy that exists. If one day there will be, I'm sure, some great technological breakthrough, and I'm all for research being done, and a lot of research is being done, and you'll find something else which is equally cheap and reliable, or maybe even more so, fine. But the object of energy policy, I think, ought to be to provide the cheapest and most reliable source of energy available. That is both economic sense, and it is absolutely vital for the poor, including the poor in the developing world, incidentally, who are even poorer than the poor people in this country. And this grandstanding, I think, at the expense of the ordinary people, I think is appalling. Unfortunately, I have a very good group, excellent. Harry also is very much part of it. And I have the most eminent board of trustees of any charitable outfit in the country. I think it is, in a small way, making an impact. So I'm very glad that I did that.
And you said repeatedly in this interview that you prefer to look forward, so yeah. Let's end with two questions that do that. The first one is, energy prices aside, what are the sort of big problems or challenges that you see in terms of the British economy? By the time this comes out, Philip Hammond will have delivered his spring budget. There's obviously inflation is rising, productivity, the deficits. I mean, what do you see the sort of...
Well, aside from energy policy, which, as I say, is a mess, and that does have economic... consequences. I rather share the view, I don't know whether you've read Mervyn King's book, which he brought up, I think, last year, called The End of Alchemy. And his position is that the flaws in the banking system, which led to the terrible meltdown in 2008, have not really been addressed properly. And I think he's right. I think that the banking sector still needs further policy changes.
And what sort of changes would those be?
Well, one change which I think is... I mean, in a sense, the government... this country, the government, the last government, George Osborne, accepted the analysis, but he didn't, I think, reach the right conclusion. I understand why he didn't, because he set up a committee, and the committee got the wrong answer, and he just followed what they did. That's the Vickers Committee. I think it is essential to separate out what used to be known as high street banking, or streaming, with what used to be called merchant banking, and it's nowadays called investment banking. I think they are quite different. Not only are they different activities, but the cultures of the two are different, very different. And the investment banking is a sort of go-go, risk-taking culture. Nothing wrong with that. But the conventional banking, high street banking, commercial banking, it needs to be a very prudent and cautious and conservative approach, quite the opposite. And I think you need a complete separation. Now, what the government has introduced is a so-called ring fence between the two, but they're not separate. The organisations are still a single organisation, and I don't think that's workable.
But the analogy I like best is the idea that a city has decided to hold a Grand Prix race on its streets, but it's still left one lane open to commuter traffic.
Right. Well, maybe, but I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that. But I think that the whole creation of the ring fence implies an acceptance of the difference between the two kinds of banking. But the idea that you can have a ring fence within a single organisation, I think it means that you don't get this complete separation of the two cultures, which is of the first importance, and it also, I think, produces an unworkable governance structure. We're at risk of a further banking collapse, and we haven't fully recovered. And not when I say we, it's not just this country. It's around the world. But of course, it's particularly important for this country because the banking sector, as a proportion of the economy, is particularly large in this country. And that's potentially a strength, but it's also, of course, if it goes wrong, it's a sort of weakness.
And, I mean, do you think this is your next great cause?
Well, I've done enough about that. I think I was on the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards and did my best there. No, I'm too old to have any more great causes. And anyhow, the sanity on the global warming front is a battle where we're winning very slowly, but we haven't yet won. I mean, we're winning in the sense that I think that the public are now don't buy into this at all. It's the political class, the chattering class, who buy into it. The general public don't. All the opinion polls mainly do. It's not surprising. I mean, if you look actually hard at the evidence, which of course these people don't, because it's a religion, and if it's a religion, you don't bother about evidence. What the records seem to suggest is that since the records first began, which is about 150 years ago, and that is actually quite a neat timing because the Industrial Revolution was about 150 years ago. So it's not just the period the records began, but it's also the period since the Industrial Revolution. That mean average global temperature has risen by 1 degree centigrade, and an awful lot in 150 years. And in the past 20 years, it has slowed down. Even that very slow rate of increase has slowed down further. So the idea that you can't cope with this by adapting to whatever is happening, particularly when modern technology gives you the capacity to adapt far greater than we've ever had before, and that instead you have to persuade people to use expensive and unreliable energy instead of cheap and reliable energy. I mean, it's lunatic. And so I'm not surprised that the public at large, and indeed a growing number of newspapers, have bought into this. Very large. When people say the greatest threat facing the world is climate change, if only it were.
Well, there's Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump is here today and gone tomorrow. The important issues are issues which have a longer impact. I mean, this is why I get slightly cross when people bracket the Brexit move with Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump is just one president in a line of a whole range of presidents of different character and nature. Whereas the Brexit decision is a fundamental and historic and long-term turning point. And the climate change issue also is something of which is an enduring issue. And the question of who happens to be president of the United States at the time is not without interest, but it is not on the same level.
Lord Lawson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor, and I hope I'll see you again next week. If you like this, please subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.